and we'll start another episode of Mentioned in Dispatch. We're in season four of Mentioned in Dispatches. Can you believe it?
That's all right. It must mean we're doing something good, or we have a lot of time on our hands.
I think it's a little of both. I think at least partially that we're just too stubborn to quit.
That's also, well, like we were just talking about with it was a Monday night, and Edward and I, Velker, were locked in an epic battle. Because, of course, it's an epic. It's the epic battle of Laon, and we're sitting there online doing the thing, and I'm going, when did I decide? I am not giving up on this project of doing all the CNC games. I am not. I'm not giving up.
Despite the fact that you probably should. Let's hope no one thinks we should have given up on this podcast by now, because I enjoy doing it. And, I mean, look, the shtick was always that we didn't want to be overly formalistic. The whole point was we wanted it to sound like a bunch of gamers hanging out and somebody just hit record on the tape recorder and, you know, outspits a show an hour later. I really wish it were that. As the guy that has to edit all this into some semblance of order, I really wish it was that easy.
Yes.
But it's close. You know, it's sort of that appeal by design. So one of the tonight's inspiration is a little off the cuff because there was a fun little discussion going on in our forums today about this long running project that a war games club, it's a minis war game over in England that has been running for a while. That is this alt history mid-30s, English Civil War. It's a very British Civil War.
Absolutely.
And, I'd never heard of it before today. I'm sure, you know, there's plenty of people now yelling at the podcast, how have you not heard of this before today? but it got me thinking that there's some pretty nifty alt history ideas out there that are not just sort of, I mean, there's fun alt history. There's sort of science fantasy-ish alt history, and then there's the more plausible kinds of alt history stuff. And for kind of the science fantasy sorts of stuff, like Space 1889, you know, look, we weren't going to Mars with 1880s technology. We just weren't. Like, that wasn't happening. You know, there's some kind of batshit crazy sorts of stuff, like Mississippi Banzai, right? The Fourth Reich or whatever it was. What was the one where the Japanese and the Germans managed to conquer the U.S. and like partition the North American continent?
You mean the Man in the High Castle?
Well, there was an actual war game a while ago that sort of had stuff going on.
Yeah. I do recall because I was thinking of Wahoo, taking of the fairly famous SPI game about the taking of Washington D.C.
Yeah.
by the Confederacy.
Yeah. There's a variety of these things. Honestly, I don't necessarily want to call it sort of science fiction kind of stuff because the technology was all roughly contemporary with the calendar in which it takes place. But the Crimson Skies series of games with the partitioned North America, grew out of sort of a fanciful, Confederate states left the Union and managed to successfully do it without the Civil War devastating the country. And then that caused a fracturing of the rest of the United States. So, you know, the Crimson Skies setup it was a little nutty, but it wasn't too far-fetched. But reading the background on the one from the very British Civil War from the Solway Minis guys, look, I don't know enough about British history to know how thoroughly implausible it would be, but it read as though it was a perfectly good setup for about a 15-faction battle royale of various sorts for you to have some fun minis war games with. And so I thought talking some alt history ideas might be kind of an enjoyable thing to do for an evening. So.
Sure.
So here we are.
The idea of a very British Civil War is actually much, much older than the game. And I don't know, I can't say for certain that I know one way or the other which came first, the chicken and the egg, but I know I've been aware of this for quite some time, this idea in the interwar period. And this particular piece all came out of the premise that the British fascists sided, and they did until, you know, the Declaration of War and the Blitz and all this stuff. They sided with the fascists. You know, there was a very substantial fascist movement within Britain during the time, and then you have, you know, you have all these other splits, you know, and my impression, which I've seen, again, I've seen this mostly at a distance, but just as I go through the different armies that have come up and the different pieces that have come out of it, I know that, and there's another piece to this, and this is why I know the most about it. The first time I ever encountered this, one of the greatest gifts that Britain ever gave to the world of Kriegsspiel was the Ordnance Survey maps.
Oh, God, yes. Those are awesome.
And, you know, they're very nearly at Kriegsspiel scale. And when you see them, you're talking about communities that are drawn down to the lamppost and the street corner and the little shed sitting behind Uncle Bernie's house.
Oh, know? Yeah.
And so if you're trying to do a Kriegsspiel-level scenario, whether it be Napoleonic Kriegsspiel or it be World War II, which I've certainly done, or if it be a in this case, a very British Civil War, these were available. So the idea, you know, the two things I've seen the most frequently, number one, of course, is Sea Lion. You know, what if Sea Lion, the German invasion of Britain in 1941, what if it goes through?
Yeah.
And what if Hitler actually does control the channel? What if he does not commit to the Blitz? You know, let Goering convince him that the Blitz will work. What if he comes in? And of course, Patty Griffith's famous, probably the most famous Kriegsspiel ever run, because it, you know, it aired on the BBC and it involved the actual participants where they attempted to Kriegsspiel out Sea Lion. Well, they're using these Great Ordnance Survey maps, and very similarly here, we could use them for this very British Civil War, where we can draw Britain in 1938 down to a pretty remarkable level of detail. So you have resources for Britain at this time that you don't have for a whole lot of other types of games. Yeah, we've got the maps and all, but this is a rare opportunity to play a skirmish game at this level, because people look at these maps, I think, sometimes, and I may be getting the causality wrong, but it's just what I saw.
Yeah.
You know, I was really jealous, because, try to run a low-level skirmish game of any kind of, say, the Danube campaign of 1809 or the Jena-Auerstadt campaign of 1806. Well, that just doesn't exist. You know, there's no such thing. And that's part of the reason that the most famous Kriegsspiel map, the Meckel map, is fictitious.
Yeah.
We have the Metz map, but it's also got, we have the Königgrätz map, but they both have rail lines on them. So there's already stuff you have to pretend isn't there. So this was so very, very cool. And it's also a remarkably colorful time. You know, the idea of Britain breaking up into all of these different factions and, you know, and fighting one another over Prince, you know, in a way that feels very War of the Roses, even though it's set in 1938 and all those other things. So there's a lot there to that. I'd like to say at the beginning, because when you told me that you wanted to talk about alt history, I think it's important, and I understand the distinction, I don't mean to be pedantic, but if you are a historical wargamer, you are by definition into exploring alt history.
Yeah, well, so I think there's the issue of exploring alt history in terms of exploring things that actually happened, right? We can refight Gettysburg 14 different ways, but we're still refighting Gettysburg. Like, Gettysburg happened, and we know what happened, and we've got pretty good records of what happened. Same thing with, you know, look, there's the magic dozen games that everybody's got to have. You know, there's the Bulge game, the Waterloo game, the Stalingrad game, the D-Day game. Like, we know those in excruciating detail. And I think really, to me, where you kind of draw that distinction is, we're refighting battles that actually happened versus changing the lead up that ever got us to battles that never could have happened. And I think that's kind of where I would draw that alt history distinction. You're right that just by its very nature, we are rearranging history. I don't necessarily know that we're rewriting it. We are certainly rearranging it.
I'm not talking necessarily about my beloved games like Waterloo or Gain Hours Time. I'm talking when you play a strategic game like, say, The Napoleonic Wars by Mark McLaughlin, or
yes.
War and Peace by Mark McLaughlin, or if you play Hearts of Iron on the PC, or if you play Europa Universalis. That is all, you know, why do we play Crusader Kings? Why do we say you play Europa Universalis? It's because we ask ourselves, well, yes, that's right. There's this battle at Gettysburg, but the minute you step above the tactical level, you know, one of the things that Doug and I definitely want to do is use the game Scharnhorst, which is a game for Blücher to play scenarios and build it. Once you step back from that tactical level, you are exploring, well, wait a minute, what if the battle happened over here? Or if you step back another level, well, okay, so we win at Gettysburg, but or what if Lee doesn't come north? I'm not going to come north into Maryland.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make that mess into Pennsylvania. When you start to ask yourself at the strategic level and at the operational level all these other things, you are sitting back a little bit, stroking your chin and saying, maybe can I make Washington fall? Can I get there? Or taking a more common game, if I don't divert resources as Napoleon to fighting in Spain, can I punch Russia's lights out in times before so I can beat the snowfall? So I think by definition we're interested in alt history that way without entering it at a point where the history has already diverged, which I think is more what we think of as alt history.
Yeah, and in my mind that was the latter part of what you just mentioned, where the history has already diverged, was sort of what I had in mind when proposing what to discuss for this evening. I think you're right that there is obviously quite a bit of difference at, you know, once you get above the operational level, for sure, even at the operational level sometimes, you are exploring things going very differently, because tactical battles don't often significantly influence the entire war. There are a few cases where that happens. But there are many times where, let's face it, any tactical engagement on the Western Front from D-Day onwards doesn't make a bit of difference to what's going to end up happening in the strategic sense to Nazi Germany, right? There was a tidal wave of American industrial production that was crashing down on that continent one way or the other. And with the Russians never running out of manpower coming from the other direction, it was done, right? It was, Nazi Germany was over. It was just a matter of when. But at the strategic level, what can you do? You know, and I think you're right in that you are inherently rewriting history as soon as you open those boxes. I'm sure you've rewritten history playing War and Peace in all sorts of interesting ways over your lifespan.
My favorite strategic game of the Napoleonic Wars is still Mark McLaughlin's War and Peace, where, honestly, the campaign game, and Mark McLaughlin himself will tell you that this classic of the form, the campaign game didn't hang together, which is why it's very exciting, by the way, as we're sitting here. Our Kickstarter copies are coming to us in the mail, so brand new, wonderful Napoleonic War game done by One Step Publishing on the way. But, it is my favorite, but on the PC, my favorite, and we've talked about it on the podcast before, is the somewhat older now March of Eagles that is from the same folks that give us Hearts of Iron and Europa Universalis, Silvered Paradox. But the thing about March of Eagles that you'll always see, and it's why you play it, and it's got the same thing that an alt game like that has, where eventually, whether, of course, it's France in my case, but I've actually played a couple games of it where I wound up having Austria conquer Europe, or I played it long enough that Spain conquered Europe. You figure out how the game plays, you figure out how to beat the AI, and you go out there and you actually have this out so that you can have this massive strategic victory for the other side. So yes, I have absolutely written that in a glorious way. Well, shoot, you can do the same thing in Napoleon Total War if you can put up with the history of the tactical combat. And the strategic player actually plays very, very well. It's a fun board game of the Napoleonic Wars. It's a bit silly in extremis, like most of those, you know, with all those games in my experience, if they don't cheat you by gimping you later in late game, sooner or later you're just going to come over a tipping point and start beating it. But that said, yeah, you spend a lot of time playing these games, trying to take over the world and turn history away, and the first thing you do is you make sure you don't invade Russia until you've dealt with Spain. Maybe you go a little, if the game allows it, you go a little easier on the continental system. And if you're me and you're in grad school and you've got your six best buddies and you're all playing Empires and Arms, you make absolutely sure that the Russians and the French spend the entire game trying to push the diplomacy track so that they can stay allied and eventually crush all the other teams.
Yeah, well.
But that again is diverting history, and I know that's not really where you're at. You're talking more about these list of games. I just pulled up the one of the list of these, and oh my goodness, it is a remarkable list just from SPI. Things like a lot of them are modern. Dixie, which is one of the games I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Operation Olympic, Sea Lion, Revolt in the East, Warsaw Pact, Rebellion in the 1970s. SPI, because of who they were and because of sort of how they did things, they made a mini industry out of publishing games that were counterfactual or, counterfactual, and just see what would happen.
Yeah. Well, and let's face it, like, SPI leaned heavily on their existence and use of a couple of pretty common systems that allowed them to rebuild scenarios and crank things out fairly quickly in that way. So they were well equipped to do that. One of the most obvious of the alt history scenarios out there was one that, we covered a couple episodes ago on the podcast, and that is how many games out there exist of a World War III that never happened.
Sure.
And at the time many of these were being published, they were contemporary or near future. The first four or five pages of the Twilight 2000 RPG book explained, it explained in a more narrative form what the title cards explained at the opening of Red Dawn, right before the Soviet paratroopers land in Colorado. It kind of explained how we got there from here. T2K takes place 25 years in the past as we are sitting here recording this. It was 10 years in the future when the game was released. And so it was an alt future at the time then, but even as an alt history now, there are parts of it that we look back and go, yeah, history didn't really pan out that way, and it probably couldn't have. But now we look at any of those, Cold War goes hot in Europe, and look, we've read some of the histories about just how close it managed to get a couple of times, but it never came to pass. But even now, looking back, it is an alt history thing. I mean, it's 35, 40 years ago as we're sitting here recording this, or more in some cases. But I think at this point, it has safely crossed the line into that kind of alt history that we're kind of talking about on this show.
I was doing a little bit of reading in advance and admittedly it was only a little bit, but I don't know. Did you see Joe Miranda's comment on this subject?
I've seen a bunch of Joe Miranda comments over the years. What's the specific one you're looking at?
This is pretty recent over at Consim World, where he said alternate history as well as sci-fi are pretty much dead topics among war gamers.
Okay.
I'm curious. I don't. And here's a case where it's hard for me to judge, because you and I both at slightly different moments in our lives, but came up during the golden age of these alt games, both Cold War Goes Hot, like you say, Twilight 2000. Now, for me, I guess it's not a surprise. Probably the biggest. And by the way, I think Miranda's just stone cold wrong about sci-fi.
Well, I'm mulling it over though, as you've mentioned it now. I'm kind of mulling it over in my head, and And on one hand, I think in the broad sense of kind of what we grew up with as adventure gaming, I would counter that it absolutely is not dead. But in terms of tabletop wargaming, I'm trying to think of, you know, some sort of classic, not necessarily classic, but some sort of significant entry into sci-fi wargaming right now that somebody is either actively promoting on a Kickstarter or is actually selling and is sort of a flagship product somewhere. Lock and Load has the Space Infantry series that's starting to ship now that most of the World at War stuff is already out. As we record this, I think some of the first boxes are starting to leave the warehouse now. But most of the sci-fi war games that I'm thinking of off the top of my head, these are ones we grew up with and certainly not anything current. I mean, how old is Starship Troopers at this point?
Sure.
Hammer Slammers, Grav Armor, Revolt on Antares, like all of these, you know, Warp War, you know, pick them. Like, where are the current tabletop war games of a sci-fi nature? There's Ogre. What else you got? Like, current. And even Ogre's a re-release of a 40-year-old design.
Well, here's... Okay, there's a whole show to be had, and Doug and I really would love to have it on the topic of Ogre. Because, you know, we spent a chunk of my 50th birthday a couple years ago at my house playing nothing but a giant exercise K on a table that was probably 8x5.
Well, I don't want to completely distract us into a full-on Ogre discussion, because you're right, we do need to invite Doug for that. But in terms of, if Joe is saying that old history and sci-fi to wargaming is largely dead, prove me wrong, or prove him wrong, not prove me wrong. Where's the big sci-fi wargame right now that makes you point to that and go, no, sci-fi wargaming isn't dead? What do you got?
GMT's got the Talon universe, which I think Space Corps is a part of, right?
Okay, so I know about Talon. It's a couple of years old at this point. We had it at Origins 2 years ago. So I do know about the Talon stuff. I didn't realize it was part of the Space Corp universe.
I think you can, and this is me having to be very careful, because let me be clear, this is not my...
This isn't your shtick.
Yeah, this is right. This is not a place where I should be talking a whole lot, but it's, you know, it's one of these things where it's certainly been well received. People have played it.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. And I'll posit this and let me see what you think. You mentioned the great ones. Obviously my favorite is Hammer Slammers. You've got, well, my favorite is Starship Troopers, but that's never really received, in my judgment, a really good tabletop iteration other than the original Avalon Hill game, which is now approaching 50 years old.
And I'm not, I'll be honest, and I'm going to commit a bit of heresy here. I'm not sure the original game holds up all that well 50 years later. I think there's a lot of rose-colored glasses that look back at that one.
Well, it is what it is. I mean, you know, that sounds flip, but it isn't. I mean, it's an honest statement to say they were in a, you know, it's a weird game for Avalon Hill to have released, for one thing.
Yeah.
They took a huge risk on a property that wasn't as well known as it probably is now.
And now it's well known for the wrong things.
Right, exactly.
Which is unfortunate.
Came out with a game that took a series of educated stabs. And it's the same thing we talk about anybody who really falls in love with a mythology. As you well know, Starship Troopers isn't a particularly thick book. And to extrapolate all the military technology and all the TONEs and all the OOBs and all the, you know, that was all speculation, right? And you can judge them one way or the other. So, but there's never been a good Starship Troopers, which is my favorite. My next favorite is certainly Hammer Slammers, of which there is a very good tabletop minis role-playing game that is now getting long in the tooth. It's been rebooted.
Even the Mayfair Games tabletop war game wasn't bad.
No. I've got that on my shelf, and You know, it's, I like it. I'll play it if you like. I mean, it's not, like you say, it's not bad. But my point is, and this really clicked with me in the context of Twilight 2000, which I played extensively. What's the name of it? With the tabletop miniatures, or not miniatures, but the tabletop war game expansion that Frank wrote.
Yeah, it was the first battle series. It was the same system that was adapted to the Team Yankee game.
Yeah, but he came out with for T2K a tactical module.
Yeah, and it's the same series that they used for the Team Yankee game, and I cannot for the life of me think of what it was called. It's the first battle series is the name of it. I'm sitting in front of, you know, the magic internet box, so let's go find it. But
yeah, Twilight 2000 tabletop board game.
Yeah.
Is that it we're looking for us?
Clearly, we're well prepared for this show.
Yeah, oh. Well, we're heading into a place that I don't know if we necessarily expected to go.
Like that's ever stopped us.
And you know, I it was because Frank has never, ever... Because look, this is the same guy that gave us Space 1889.
Yes.
You know, so he's never, ever been able to give up the idea of this interface between role-playing and wargaming.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know. I go back and forth on it. Let me just say that much. But to my point, Twilight 2000 was this intense, as you know, this intensely crunchy, modern for its time, actually futuristic for its time.
You're looking for the last battle. Was the Twilight 2000 war game.
Is that what it's called?
Last Battle.
Okay. And, you know, so that thing, that whole series that is Twilight 2000, becomes this super crunchy, you know, you're counting every round of ammo, which they, by the way, later admitted was wrong. Even Frank did. And they did this in a very intense role-playing game that I played to death. A lot of my friends played. We loved it. I don't know... where, especially since, as you correctly observe, the history has moved past it. I was fascinated that they tried to reboot it and try to rejigger the history to get it right.
Yeah, yeah.
Since it's like I felt that was a stupid exercise. I did that, and now
they'd have been better off just ripping off Harold Coyle's alt history of his series, the Nancy Kozak series. So.
Yeah, and I just go on to, I think it's RPG Vault, and download the entire Twilight 2000 package for a couple bucks. It's well worth having.
Yeah.
If you don't want to go to Half Price Books and own the books yourselves for a few dollars, there's certainly a whole lot of games still there if you just push past a lot of the bric-a-brac. But I wonder how many of us that were so obsessed with, oh my God, this is so cool. Because I know for my friends, the big deal was those vehicle cards.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and studying those cards and, you know, and the armor porn and all that other stuff and pursuing that and interesting in that. I don't know where those people have gone, but they certainly seem to have left.
Well, I think some of them are now hoarding Osprey books. Some of them are still clutching their out-of-print, tall, skinny hardcovers from Salamander Press. I suspect a handful of them will be gathering at Historicon, assuming it doesn't get canceled for coronavirus threats, given that damn near everybody at Historicon is in the danger population.
That's a Roger.
So,
despite what Colonel Bill Gray retired wants to tell you, he's always posting, and I'm like, dude, no.
Many of them are probably hanging out on their recliners yelling at the TV news, so... Back to your quote from Miranda in terms of, you know, him saying that alt history and sci-fi are largely irrelevant to war game, whatever that specific quote was, the more we've discussed it and the more I'm thinking about it, I don't know as he's wrong if we're talking the kind of alt history that I had originally sort of framed this around for tonight. You're not releasing a Mississippi Banzai type game today. Nobody cares. Everybody's going to roll their eyes and go, yeah, that's dumb. You're not going to get a legitimate war game that's built off of the premise of the U.S. invasion of Canada in 1812, 1813 was actually successful and somehow partitioned Canada, or vice versa, that the British burning of Washington somehow resulted in a split in the nascent United States and we've got a multi-nation North America. and then build a war game from there. Like, those kinds of things aren't really floating around out there. Obviously, you know, Cold War goes hot in Europe. World War III is the key driver of what would probably be deemed as sort of alt history kind of stuff. But even the World at War series, as Lock and Load has rebooted it, has a limited amount of backstory of here's why the shooting started. They're just starting from, all right, tank go boom, play game. You know, and it just, they kind of strip a lot of that away and say, all right, let's go fight the war. Let's, who cares why the war started? Let's go start the war. And so I'm not sure Miranda's wrong on this one. There's clearly, especially Modern War magazine right now from Decision Games, has a whole lot of post-World War II stuff that there's some historical things in there that have some ahistorical variants. There's obviously some forward-looking things in there, like a Russia-China kind of shootout. But there's not a ton of alt history that really significantly changes the run-up to the shooting war. At the time that SPI published Mukden in the Mod Quad 1 that had the Russians and Chinese fighting a border war, that wasn't really all that implausible. It's not like you needed to really concoct a backstory as to how this shooting started. You just kind of said, you know, one day the Russians and Chinese got pissed at each other and started shooting. You know, nobody really batted an eye at that. We just sort of said, sounds good to me, and went with it.
So let's try to categorize this for the sake of keeping our own sanity, right?
You know, sure.
Alt history, I think, level one. Level one is you're playing a strategic game, and because of your success, now history diverges. Napoleon doesn't go into Russia without dealing with Spain. Hitler doesn't. He keeps the Hitler Ribbentrop Pact or the Ribbentrop Stalin Pact intact and doesn't invade in June of 1941 and deals with England. Or, you know, the simplest thing I've ever heard, he takes Malta and the British are forced to sue for peace.
Yeah.
You know, so that's one form of alt history, but I don't know if that's necessarily what you had in mind, because that's what's going here. The other kind, as you say, is variant scenarios. The most famous being, in my mind, France 1940 from Avalon Hill, where the designer says, look, the game that I've given you that is on all the setup sheets is not history. Because if I gave you history, you'd think this was the dumbest game you had ever played.
Yeah.
Or that, well, look, if you're the German, you're going to feel like you're some sort of freaking genius, and if you're the French, you're going to feel like you just, you know, caught 6 feet up your backside.
Yeah, which is kind of what happened.
But you can pull out a sheet that says, if you want the historical strengths and setups, here they are. So, perversely, the game as released is alt history.
Yeah.
But it's ultimately a variant scenario. And the most famous from my... You know, from my loves is that Waterloo game where Grouchy shows up on time,
which makes for a very short fight.
it makes for a better fight because Napoleon wins. but it's, you know, so so that's another thing. So we've got the games that allow you to diverge from history later. You've got the games you've got the games that allow you to do that. And then yes, you have the alt future games, but I don't think that's alt history. That's alt future. What I think we're mostly talking about, and the things that were the real strengths of these things, were the games that began with what about premises?
Yes.
And those were, and boy, because I'm going to tell you, video gamers seem to love them.
Well, yeah, I would have to see the sales figures to know for sure, but I'm willing to bet that the Crimson Skies Xbox game was far more successful than the Crimson Skies Minis tabletop game.
And that may be solely because of the platform.
The example
that I give is probably question mark. My favorite non-historical war game thing that exists is BioShock Infinite. I adore BioShock Infinite. It was a game that after I finished it, my son and I finished it, I went back and I went, wait a minute. What? holy crap. And I almost played the whole thing back through to see everything back through the lens of what you find out happens at the end. But spoiling that game is not my point. It posits, because part of the meditation of the game is alternative views of how reality works, or, you know, a non-traditional view, I guess, of how reality works, it compels you to imagine alternate histories. In this particular case, America.
Well, so a question on Bioshock Infinite, though, because I don't know enough about it, so this is information seeking, not nitpicking. Is that one that is plausible within the technological limitations of the time in which it is supposed to take place? Because to me, that's where Space 1889 really breaks this. Space 1889 is a fun, historical-flavored sci-fi game, but the technology of the 1880s were not such that anything in Space 1889 could actually come to pass, leaving aside the fact that Mars doesn't have a breathable atmosphere. Like, ignore that stuff. There was no way we could get to Mars with what we had available in 1889. Therefore, you can't consider Space 1889 to be in any way historical. Unlike something like Crimson Skies, biplanes in the 1930s were there. Like, we've got footage of them, you know?
I will tell you that from my perspective on that, first of all, of course, I like Space 1889 even more than I like Twilight 2000, because it's much more my jam.
Oh, it's a blast.
If you're going to argue that, yes, Liftwood, the secret substance that allows us to sail the ether waves of the vacuum of space to get from the Earth to Mars, that is on a high on the implausibility scale, I will stipulate.
Yeah.
Is what is posited there, it is what is posited in Bioshock Infinite is more plausible, but it does not reach to the level of, you know, it's not merely a steampunk universe, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Part of reading the very British Civil War, part of what made that so compelling is it wasn't some off-the-wall technological advancement that suddenly caused history to diverge. It was a bunch of personalities acting not implausibly like egotistical assholes can act when they are high up in government and very powerful. And you're reading that going, yeah, I can see that, you know. To be fair, there's a multiplicative effect in a very British Civil War that pretty much the worst thing that could happen at every key juncture is what did happen. But there's no really weird technological divergence that makes you go, I'm not so sure about that. Like, that's why I was asking about Bioshock Infinite.
Yeah, and that's certainly reasonable. But here's one. All right, let's move away from that one. Although I think it's better than 1889, which that's a pretty low bar. I'll stipulate. Another of my favorite divergences, again in video games, is the Fallout universe. And the thing that most people don't know about the Fallout universe, the thing that predicates the whole thing, and this is plausible. What happens if the transistor is never invented and suddenly everything is tubes?
Yep.
And it asks you to think through the whole process of what happens if the miniaturization doesn't occur, if the energy efficiency doesn't occur, and we naturally then flow to atomic power.
Yeah.
In a way that we didn't wind up having to. So my point with all that is not to talk about video games, which is obviously not what we're on about. But it's to say that there is still an impulse to explore alternative histories. I just wonder where it's gone from the war game space.
Yeah.
And the other piece is, I don't have a good answer to that. I know the desire is there. I know I enjoy it. And I've read other people, I've seen people do videos where they explain these things, and it's all very cool. But then you turn to sci-fi. And you say, and I'm talking about, you know, probably the greatest sci-fi show of our time right now is The Expanse.
Okay.
I think it's better than anything Star Trek is doing. And that's a pretty crunchy, hard, low-tech sci-fi relative to being sci-fi. That's had two, I think. I know at least one, but I think two very successful games. They're not war games.
Yeah.
They're board games.
Well, I think when you end up with, this is the warning, very broad proclamations ahead. I think when you start attempting to inhabit fictional universes, you have to make them inherently personality and character driven games for people to truly get the immersion. And the example I'll give of that is I will call back to an earlier mention. You mentioned the Hammer Slammers game, there was a war game back in the mid 80s, the one with the funky puzzle boards that you put together, from Mayfair, and the Hammer Slammers game was a good tank combat game. It wasn't great, but as a guy who loved the Slammers books and can still recite chapter and verse of many of the stories from the original series as well as several of the spinoff books, that wasn't what you were playing in that board game. You weren't playing out the Hammer Slammers universe. You were playing Panzerblitz with laser cannons. And that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, but it was significantly distracting for when you wanted to feel like you were inhabiting the Slammerverse somehow, and that's not what you were playing on the tabletop there. And you contrast that with any of the Battletech scenarios involving the Grey Death Legion after the first couple of Grey Death Legion books had come out, right? You've got Decision at Thunder Rift, and you can get Battletech games on the table, and because you've got that one mech that represents Grayson Death Carlisle stomping around the battlefield, you feel much more immersed in it. And it's not figure versus counter, that's the personalization of what that figure represents, where those counters in the Hammerverse didn't really make you feel like those were the Slammers. And that's not an issue of counters versus minis. That's an issue of the scale at which you were operating.
You and I have both spent time at one time or another playing Starfleet Battles. And
I made it through one session of Starfleet Battles and decided it wasn't for me.
Sure. And that's, I had a group of guys, I've talked about them before, here up in Milwaukee, this was their thing. And in fact, if you go to Gen Con, they're still there. This is their jam and they will not stop. They will die playing this game, and God bless them always. My point being, for them, they identified so viscerally with the ships that they were playing, they would get into fights.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I think you're right to an extent. Now, part of it is design, right? The design for them didn't get in the way. I absolutely understand anybody who tells me that Starfleet Battles is just too damn much.
Yeah.
You know, but for those for whom it was a good thing, those ships were very personal and very relatable. But I think now, and I'm just trying to think of I would have to go to a sales site to see this, but I'm going to surmise something. That the most popular sci-fi games, probably by a distance right now, are Twilight Imperium 5, The Expanse, Star Trek, or Star Wars, either Armada or TIE Fighter, I can never tell. You know, whichever one, because those are both gigantic.
Yeah.
And, probably...
Are you counting the role-playing games, or are you just talking tabletop?
No, I'm talking about board games, things that might be close to a war... I mean, I'm trying to get at the point that where this wargaming energy left, it went into hobby gaming.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
And people went, well, shoot, I can't stand the model or the rules for X-Wing versus, what's it called? I've even forgotten now.
The
miniature game. The Star Wars.
The Attack Wing.
Attack Wing, thank you. No, Attack Wing is the Star Trek one.
There's, I think there's one of each.
Is there?
Yeah, because there was also a D&D Attack Wing that was Dragon Combat.
That was Dragon Wing, yeah. Okay, this is so, I feel so stupid. Because Legion is their ground minis game.
Yeah. In any event...
But that game, I can't stand its model because I hate how extortionately expensive it is. But for people who are into it, those, when we're kids, those are wargamers.
Yeah. Well, you've missed the 800-pound gorilla in the room. You missed BattleTech.
Well, I think that Star Wars crushes it.
Star Wars at the moment, Star Wars does, but I'm betting BattleTech's ahead of Twilight Imperium.
I doubt it.
Really? I'd be curious to see.
That's a fair question. I'm open to it, but I doubt it. I think that just given the muscle that's behind FFG, and let's make a point that you and I have made in the past many times, just because I want to show how right we are about this.
Take a victory lap here.
that's exactly what this is. I'm going to take this victory lap till hell will not have it. You pull down just about any rule set that you've got up there on your shelf. A few exceptions. Certainly Starfleet Battles is one of them. Oh, yeah, it's just called X-Wing.
Okay.
It's Star Wars X-Wing. I love the minis. They're gorgeous. Can't stand it. Can't stand a thing about it. And people play it a lot. And then Armada, where they want to take the Star Destroyers and fly them around the screen. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Anyway, these people who, with very few exceptions, if you take down our rule sets, Hammer Slammers, Starship Troopers, they're not any more complicated than the rules you've got for these games. Certainly they're not as complicated as Twilight Imperium 5. You're playing war games. They just don't have toys in them. If complexity or depth or length of play is what's keeping you away, no, you're into the bright, shiny, colored things. And that's fine. Enjoy the toys. Why would I play with toy soldiers? I'm not here to judge you.
You play with digital toy soldiers.
I do. I don't even have real ones in any Aristotelian sense.
Yeah, you could put hover tanks in the tank on tank rule set and sell minis for it, and I'll bet suddenly Tuesday night becomes tank on tank night at Gamers Armory.
So these people, so if you want to know, Joe, Mr. Miranda, if you want to know where all the the sci-fi war gamers went,
they're not playing war games.
I think you got to go look and see these other games.
Yeah.
They're getting to live in the universes that excite their imaginations in substantial ways. Same with fantasy.
Yeah.
I will never not love Hordes of the Things, the great WRG miniatures game of some antiquity. We played on Saturday Night Fights a game called 10,000 Orcs in an Ice Cream Truck that was based on a game called Fistful of Miniatures designed up here. These were fantasy war games. Well, guess where those are? They're over in the hobby game space.
Yeah. They're battle lore.
They're playing battle lore. Yeah. Which, again, great. They love it. They're having fun, which is the whole stinking point. But they, therefore, a game that is crunchier, doesn't have the cool toys, doesn't have the gorgeous maps, it's going to lose. It's because people only have so much to spend their money on. And in a competitive market, the bright shiny is usually going to win. Like you say, take tank on tank and make it hover tank, and suddenly people go, ooh.
Well, you got to have collectible minis with it, though.
Right. It's got to be collectible so that people can line up every Wednesday, right as the truck pulls up, to spend their extra money. God almighty, what was the name of that damn fool Star Wars dice game? It was just dice. And people lined up for it.
I don't remember the Star Wars dice game. I remember there was the Quarriors game in the mid-90s. And
right,
there was
became, what was it?
There was also the TSR collectible dice game, whose name is totally escaping me.
That actually might be Dice Masters, but no, the Star Wars game was Destiny.
Okay,
this was a Star Wars dice game. It was a collectible dice game. It's like, guys, just what are you doing? But it's a universe about which obviously they care a lot.
Oh yeah,
respect. expect that they want to feel immersed in it. And this is how, so again, to Mr. Miranda, where did the fantasy people go? Where did the start? Where did the sci-fi people go? They're over here. Where did the alt, since this is notionally the topic that you wanted us to talk about, where did these alt history people go? That, to me, some of them seemingly have gone into video games, because I think some of that's there.
Now, I'll tell you where I think they are. I think they're role-playing. Quite frankly, I think they're off role-playing in those alternate universes, and that they would rather be telling the more personal stories that inhabit those alt history universes than the wargaming universe. And quite frankly, I think there's two reasons for it. I think one, part of what's so compelling about those alt histories are the narratives, are the tales you tell. There was a great book that I had picked up somewhere along the way at like a dollar sale at a used bookstore somewhere, called For Want of a Nail. And it was basically that the U.S. lost Saratoga and the American Revolution failed.
Okay.
And so you ended up with what were the 13 colonies still beholden to Britain, but the westward expansion still sort of scratched that independence itch. And as people moved west, and particularly west and south, the United States of Mexico became a real player on the North American continent, and later you ended up with some open warfare roughly along kind of a Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee area as the United States of Mexico expanding north and west bumped into the British colonies attempting to expand west as well. That alt history might make for some entertaining tabletop gameness, but what's really compelling about it are the personalities involved and the people whose stories you're telling as a part of all of this. And that lends itself more to that role-playing adventure gaming genre than it does to tabletop wargaming. And while we've been talking, I pulled up a thread from Board Game Geek that I had actually jumped in on at one point, talking about sci-fi operational land combat war games. This guy was talking about searching for sci-fi war games based on operational or strategic scale land combat and fiction worlds. I'm not interested in space combat between spaceships, something like OCS, but in the future. And a lot of people threw out a variety of suggestions, many of which were down on the tactical level. Things like Nuclear Winter or Ogre or Starship Troopers. Federation Empire came up, and that's probably, you know, a little higher level than he was looking for. Somebody mentioned Grav Armor. Grav Armor is Panzerblitz. It's not OCS, right? Nuclear Winter, those are platoon-level counters. That's not space combat. And so the comment that I had made in there is, and this is true of some of the alt history stuff as well, you're not going to run into a ton of operational level sci-fi war games that are OCS in space, in large part because at that point you're abstracting out a lot of the tactical level technology, the laser guns, hover tanks, jetpacks, etc., those things that make sci-fi games cool. And you could almost draw a fictional map, change the colors on the OCS counters, call it the War on Sedefus 5, and have what you're looking for, right? Because at that point, what's cool about the sci-fi stuff is kind of disappears into those counters that you're pushing around. The place where there's a bit of an exception to that is the initial landing and the high planetary scale combat you get in the Battletech universe with the dropships, with the Battle Force tabletop game. You kind of get that some. You also have sort of the old Renegade Legion stuff that you had from Faza back when they were around. But a lot of the higher scale alt history stuff just becomes other color counters you're pushing around on a map, and the story isn't as detailed at that point. And I think that's why the folks that are really interested in the stories of the alt history may have moved out of wargaming. I got a second point I'll come back to, but I'll let you react to that first.
No, I actually agree with you on this one, because the more I think about it, but just talking about alt history now. Okay.
Yes.
The greatest alt history that I've ever role played is the Deadlands universe.
Okay.
And the Deadlands universe says, you know, Gettysburg happens. But at the very same time, an aggrieved Native American shaman goes into the Deadlands, goes into the hunting grounds, and wakes up these ancient spirits, these Manitous. And instead of a significant Union victory, there's a rising of the dead from the battlefield who continue the battle and terrify everybody around, and America splits. And by the time you get into the game as the erstwhile adventurer, the Confederate States still exist, the Union still exists, but there's now a huge area out west that is broken into multiple factions, and the Native Americans have held on to their territory in the Dakotas.
Yeah. And that's, quite frankly, that's not terribly different than the map that you end up with in the 1930s for Crimson Skies.
Right. And so, yes, they do introduce magical stuff. They do introduce edge tech, you know, steampunk things. And, of course, most famously, Ghost Rock, which is a mystical thing. But if I usually dump the Ghost Rock, to be honest, because I never much cared for it. But now that you say that, I've played Deadlands. I've played Savage Worlds. Both, really, all the Weird Wars settings.
Yeah, yeah.
All the Weird Wars. They've now got Rome, World War One, World War Two, and probably the best of them, in my judgment, Vietnam, because it's got a very strange take on the history.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can, as you correctly say, really inhabit that. You know, you're right. What do we want to do? We want to do two things in a historical role-playing opportunity. Number one is we want to touch the history. I want to be walking down a hallway somewhere, and the other way comes Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah.
And I want my dungeon master, or if I'm the dungeon master, I want to give the player a quick opportunity to have a realistic interaction. You know, you're not going to become best friends, boon companions, unless that's the story, I guess. But generally speaking, you're not going to have, but you had this moment. Mm-hmm. Where you saw McNamara pass your chopper, it was heading off to Yadrong or whatever it might be. But the other thing you want to do is potentially, depending on the type of game you're playing, change that history or see how you fit into it.
Yeah.
And that exploration of history, that idea of how does humanity relate to the history, yeah, I think really, now that you've said it, I think that's right on. That is where people have wandered and continue to want. Now, obviously, fantasy is a whole different question.
Yeah.
But when it comes to people that are playing historical games or historic-like games, you know, people playing steampunk, people playing Victorian games.
Well, the Assassin's Creed stuff. Series that jumps around history as well. So,
you know, that's what they're doing. They're trying to, you know, have their character dip their toe into a narrative, into a moment.
Yeah.
And explore in the way we did. Now, are we doing it in a crunchy technological way? No. Are we doing it in a way that respects orders of battle? Well, you could. You know, maybe you're the guy, maybe it's your role to not have Lee's plans discovered wrapped around a cigar outside Antietam.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that you stuff it into your pocket and go the other way. But for those who really do want to deep dive in history and have that exploration and think that through, we've always been a little bit suspect of, you know, this whole thing about how well we're really simulating history. We're meditating on it, we're reflecting on it, but simulating it, I think that has real limits.
I told you I was going to come back to a point on sort of where these guys went. As you were asking, I'll be honest, I think one of the things that has happened as the Wargamers have grown up a bit, I think some of the fanciful notions of these alt history ideas, quite frankly, have gotten bah humbugged out of Wargaming. I think, and we all know these guys, I think anytime somebody comes up with something that would be an interesting alt history scenario, you immediately have 10 naysayers jump in and tell you why it couldn't have happened, wouldn't have happened, shouldn't have happened, and goddamn it, will never happen. And there's no arguing with these dudes. They just completely suck the fun out of what should just be a lighthearted romp through an interesting thought exercise by giving you every reason why you're wrong. And at some point, you just get sick of hearing about how wrong the world needs to be, and you're like, all right, fuck it, forget it, I'm just not dealing with this. the example that I will bring up, and I went looking for it. I thought I had dragged it into our forums at some point, but I guess not. There was an interesting variant scenario at the end of, kind of tucked in at the end of the Cactus Throne game from Against the Odds magazine, and really where I think it came from is they had about four extra spaces on the counter sheet, so they threw some stuff in just for fun. And that was the idea that if the Imperialists could actually win that Mexican Civil War in the early 1860s, would they have made a push for Texas as a combination of let's distract the Mexican population that we just, you know, beat into submission, and let's maybe make a land grab at a fractured United States that's just coming off of their own war and may not have the stomach or the ability necessarily to fight back. And it would make for an interesting, you know, sort of operational level exploration of what would the Mexicans crossing the Rio Grande look like in 1865, 1866. On one hand, you've got a whole lot of Union soldiers that are nearby, but not, I mean, they're a month away, that are ready to go home. And they're like, Jesus, now we got to go fight another war. But on the other hand, you've got a very battle-hardened, solid, ready-to-fight, successful army that's probably pissed off about not being able to go home. And would this fight be over really quickly? And I think it would make for an interesting exploration of one of those gee whiz what if kind of things. And I think that's a place where you could actually have a war game, not so much a tabletop adventure game, because the characters aren't really all that interesting. Depending on whose side Santa Ana's on this week, like, that's the one name in all of this that people know. Even I screwed up and got Hooker and Sheridan's first names backwards when I was talking about this and online one day. People don't know who the hell knows who Napoleon III is, right? You recognize Napoleon's name and you're like, oh yeah, Napoleon, but then Napoleon III? Who's that dude? You know, right? I know, but.
Yeah, I figured I knew you were stipulating, so I didn't jump.
Yes. But there aren't a lot of very identifiable characters in this case. Yeah, you could turn Sherman around from the Carolinas and send him back out to Texas to go join the fight, but he's a month and a half away from getting there. Even if there were rail lines still in existence that he could get on to get there, it would make for an interesting operational level fight. But anytime you bring it up, you know, the Bah Humbug Brigade shows up and tells you 10,000 reasons why it couldn't happen. And after a while, you're like, all right, screw it. I don't feel like dealing with these guys.
Yeah, and you're right. I'm going to say it again. You're right. Two for two. I was very involved with Chris Engel and his Matrix games years ago. And I have a lot of respect for them. I think they were innovative. They remain so. I have a lot of respect for the way Dr. Patty Griffith, used them in war game development, the Great War Game Consortium out of England. And I just remember that one of the great things a Matrix game could do is it could let you play an operational game with a minimum of the overhead that never really was that representative anyway. And it would allow you narratively to choose choices and options in a situation just like the one you're describing and really get down into the alternative history. How could this come out differently? But I was once involved in a Matrix game online of the Battle of Rorke's Drift. And I argued because the way the character representing charge, because in a Matrix game you're never really the person, you're sort of an invisible hand nudging people one way or the other and making arguments about their actions. I made the argument that at a certain point Chard would shoot the minister, you know, because of the way he was pushing his men to desert and he was encouraging his men to put down their arms and become pacifists.
Yeah,
that he would shoot him. And all of a sudden, all these guys jumped up and said, well, that's not a choice. And I said, why isn't that a choice? Isn't that a choice? I understand that it's morally objectionable and I have to make a really good argument for it, but why can't I make that argument? You want to say that my argument requires a six? Fine, I get it. That's the hardest thing in the world. That's fine. The idea that it's impossible because you have a version of history in your head that has to be that way, well, now this, I think, and that, I think, is what you see a lot of on the Board Game Geek boards whenever people talk about an ahistorical board game, one that comes, whether it be alternative history or a variant, whatever it might be. Well, this sucks because it's not what really happened.
Yeah. Well that's the point.
Right. Right. That's true. It is not. And by the way, they didn't try to pretend it was.
Yeah.
They said it wasn't. But then they said, well, let's go all the way back to my favorite example, France 1940. He said, you know, are you mad at France 1940 because the out-of-the-box way to play the game is the non-historical scenario?
I think, honestly, in a lot of cases, a bunch of these dudes, that Bah Humbug Brigade out there, I really believe that in a lot of those cases, those guys are just trying to show off how smart they are to no one's enjoyment but their own. And I would even argue that in some cases, not even to their own. You know, I really think that's where a lot of that comes from. And it's unfortunate, but that's just sort of the world in which we're stuck living at this point.
And again, I mean, we're certainly, and we shouldn't give them more air than they deserve, I guess. You know, because if we want to play a Matrix game that has profound counterfactuals, we should do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we should play, and we should explain why we're doing it and move on. If we choose to play an historical game and they want to come in and say we got our history wrong, don't you think it gets to me every now and again that for the last year and a half I've been playing a Kriegspiel on the 1809 campaign, and one of the commanders is I think he is still the acknowledged expert on the battle?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, you know, he, at least in the English language, he's the guy. And you know what? Except one time in the very early going, as a clarification, he's never once tapped me on the shoulder and questioned anything.
Yeah.
You know, so it seems to me that somebody who has every right to be proud, comfortable with who he is, he just is. And the other individuals, well, maybe they don't merit the attention we give them.
I've told the story a few times of... And you were there, right? The Persian incursion game when Larry Bond walks in as we're getting ready to start. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, right? Like the guy, the legend who designed the game that we're about to bastardize is walking in to watch us, you know, destroy his creation here. And then it turned out to actually be a really great time. And he had a lot of fun watching us completely tear his creation apart.
Yeah. And because you know what? He's Larry freaking Bond.
Yeah.
We know who he is. We know how good he is at what he does. He's not worried.
No.
He's not worried that he's going to lose his place because a bunch of yutzes sitting around having a good time with his game are somehow doing it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
You know, he's good. His place is secure.
Yeah. And it was a damn fun time, too.
Yeah, sure. For you, maybe.
For anyone who's curious, there are actually still videos online of parts of that game.
it was an absolutely wonderful time.
I think we might have to link them to this podcast episode. Yeah, it's amazing. We've made it all the way through an hour podcast of talking about alt history and counterfactuals. We never once mentioned Gearkrieg, right? We've not talked Dust at all, although Dust starts to drift into that science fantasy realm because it's the alien technology that landed in Antarctica during World War II. Like, I got all that. There's a variety of these.
And I want to be very clear when I say this. Those are very good games. I want everybody to hear that they're enjoyable.
Oh, yeah.
I've played. However, you know, this goes to my point. Where did the science fiction people go?
Yeah. Well, they went to go play Dust, which... The original Dust, not Dust Tactics, but the original Dust, I will say this till the cows come home. What's your phrase? Till hell won't have it. Dust, the original Dust board game fixes everything that was wrong with Risk and does it with much cooler minis.
Yeah, it's a blast.
Yeah.
I played it. And by the way, they brought it to Historicon. They played it. And about 80% of the people at Historicon went, oh, cool. Let's play that. And 20% went, oh.
Yeah.
and guess what those 20% did? Cheated themselves out of a good time.
Yeah. Well, or they went and found something with which they actually had a good time, and that's cool. Like,
no, and that's it. But my point is, don't Why you gotta harsh somebody else's mellow? Yeah. It's all right. It's all right. You know, if you want to play this, it's, you know, I had a good time playing it. Is it something I'm going to play every week? Is it something I'm going to obsess about and never tire of? Of course not.
Yeah.
And frankly, am I going to buy one piece of it? No, I will play with your toys. Thank you very much.
Well, and my copy of Dust was a review copy, so it's not like I even paid for mine. So.
And on the other hand, if you come to my house, I have Napoleonic toys that I will play with you. So it's that's having a healthy ecosystem for any type of gaming. But, you know, and I don't pretend to have had this wisdom when I walked into our conversation, but now that we've been having it for over an hour, I think that I am comfortable saying that most of the folks who are into sci-fi and fantasy drifted into the hobby board gaming market. A few stuck around to do things like 40K and Dust and things like that. And that the folks that loved the true alternative history, as we defined it, narrowly, have wandered over into RPGs.
Yeah, and I think these days, where we grew up with adventure gaming very broadly defined,
yes.
I think these days, guys that self-identify as wargamers do not include the 40K guys, do not include the Dust guys, I'm not sure include the Dust Tactics guys. They certainly don't include the Axis and Allies and Zombies guys. I think the Square Buttons Brigade are very narrowly self-defined, which is fine. If that's who you want to be, that's cool. I think it goes back to don't harsh somebody else's mellow. And just because it's not your thing doesn't mean somebody else can't have a good time with it.
Right.
So no, I think there's times when we lose sight of that.
And that's the weird thing. It's like the only thing that I do stress about is when people say, oh, there are war games over here. No, there's not. They're good games. They're fine, and you should play them. And I will, but it's as I've wandered more and more into my miniature space, I have become just all the more aware of how expansive board gaming has become and how many people are, and this is just sort of filling my head with thoughts as we've gone through this last hour. But if you think about the way people are playing space games in the tabletop space, and again, Twilight Imperium 5, Star Wars Rebellion, Star Wars X-Wing, Expanse, and lighter fare like Space Cadets and all this other stuff. Well, shoot. I mean, I love Starship Troopers like the crazy uncle I never had. But none of the games I just mentioned, if you open them up next to Starship Troopers,
yeah,
would you go, oh, well, Starship Troopers is the more lovely game. It draws me to it more. Please let me have these narrowly defined 10-point font rules and cardboard counters.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the idea that, you know, 10-year-old Brant and 10-year-old Jim wouldn't have been drawn just like everybody else over to play this really wonderful, complicated game, Rebellion. Because don't you even get me started that Rebellion is some easy game. It isn't. It's a four-hour, relatively complicated game. It's glorious, but it's a complicated game.
Yeah.
And you know, 10-year-old Jim would have checked out into that in a minute. I know I would have, and I hope I still would have hated X-Wing because I was right about that. Yeah, I would have been right. But so many of these other games that are out there, Twilight Imperium, I've played it a bunch. It's really freaking good.
Yeah, it's tough for a 10-year-old Brant to say the same thing, given that 10-year-old Brant was playing Red Star, White Star with my dad. So that's
This is the other thing is that I've got an 11-year-old son, as you know, going on 12. And what he knows of gaming fits into two very narrow boxes.
Yeah.
It's a narrow PCs and Napoleonics.
First of all, can I be slightly disheartened by the fact that your boy is almost 12? Or is 12?
Yes.
that hurts.
Yes. Well, if you saw the picture of him heading out to his event as Adam Ant, the same one I played on the Armchair Dragoons Saturday Night, showed on the Armchair Dragoons Saturday Night Fights, it's just, as a good friend of ours posted when we posted that to Facebook, I seriously, literally, not metaphorically, looked at him first when you brought down the ultrasound and I saw him as a fetus.
Yeah.
And now he's doing this nonsense. So
yeah.
He's already punching through that time. He got to it earlier than I ever did. But he's now punching through that time when I fell madly, deeply, passionately in love with war games. And he's still about 3 years short of where I first fell in love with Napoleonic. So it's going to be very, very interesting because that space is so – I mean there is no basement that I can take him to and show him a 40-foot-long by 4-foot-wide Napoleonic setup and inspire his imagination that way. That's gone.
Yeah.
That's gone now. I can take him to Historicon. We may go one of these years. But short of that – you know, it's not a thing anymore.
The flip side is you get to do it all with all your friends online these days, so.
Well, and by the way, let it be observed that not only is Armchair Dragoon Saturday Night Fights one of the finest ways to watch wargaming anywhere, it's also 100% declared free of the coronavirus.
Fair enough. On that note, we need to call this a night. We are well past the hour mark. I'm 30 minutes overdue for being back into the main house here. And the Canes beat up on Detroit tonight, so that's cool too. I got to watch hockey in the background. So, thank you for kind of jumping in off the cuff when the original plan for tonight sort of fell through. I think this was certainly an interesting discussion, obviously unplanned, but I won't say as we necessarily reached any conclusions, but there's certainly a lot of food for thought, and I half expect some rambling Jim Screed to show up in my inbox in the next couple of days over this.
You gave me some really good thoughts. It may well happen.
And we appreciate the audience for sticking with us through this kind of rambling exploration of what exactly we mean by alt history and whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing and where'd all the sci-fi gamers go. So armchairdragoons.com, Saturday Night Fights, if you want to come check them out on Saturday night. Come hang out with us. Come chat with us. Come see us at Origins, assuming it still happens. And we'll talk next time. So, Jim, good night. Good morning, good afternoon, depending on when the audience is listening to this. Appreciate you swinging by.
Absolutely. A real pleasure to be here.
And we'll do this all again another time. So, thanks, audience, and we're out.